If another civilization parked in Earth orbit and studied our planet today, what conclusion would they come to? They would hear the staccato chatter of 6.4 billion beings racing around the globe, not to mention the insect, the animal life, singing, chirping, and I would say, crying too. They'd also witness that we are still separated from each other by culture, race, belief, and many other variables. But they would see that we were not able to really live together in community, that we could actually be family and a global family. There are many instances of communities from New Zealand's Riverside community in Nelson to James K. Baxter's in Whanganui, and sadly the failed experiment of Centrepoint here in Albany that had so much potential. And then when we look overseas, we have the Findhorn in Scotland, Auroville in India, as well as the ashrams of many Indian gurus, from Sri Aurobindo, Bhagwan Rajneesh, who had a huge community also up in Oregon. And of course, there's the farm in Tennessee in the USA, which at one stage, 3,000 people. We have also Crystal Waters in Australia and many, many more groups, quite often quietly hidden away, living, doing and being out of the public spotlight. On the phone this morning, I have Lippi Chalmers of the Eco Neighbourhood in Swanson to tell us how her group of intentional community people came together to form a neighbourhood. So, good morning, Lippi.
Good morning.
Well, I can hear a blackbird in the background. Is it a blackbird or thrush? I'm very happy.
I think it's actually a thrush, actually. I'm sitting in my garden here at Earthsong, and I think it's actually a thrush, yeah.
Good. Now, Earthsong, well, you're walking your talk, or your beings that surround you are singing to you. How did you come to Earthsong?
Okay, it was quite a long and winding road, really. Our founding member, Robin Allison, had been overseas, and she had visited a co-housing community in America. And she was at the time a solo mum with two young boys, and she thought, I would really love my children to live in a village environment like this, with lots of adult role models and just in a whole community setting. And so she came back to New Zealand and held a public meeting and introduced people to the idea of co-housing. And co-housing is a movement that started in Denmark, I think back in the 80s. And basically, there are now hundreds of co-housing communities around the world. I believe there's 100 just in Denmark alone. There's now some in Germany, in the UK, in America. I think there's about 5 in Australia, and we are New Zealand's first. And what we all have in common in co-housing, we have several things in common. One is that basically a group of people get together, buy a piece of land, and design and build their own houses on it. And it's very important that the residents themselves do that, because they're making their own community or village, really. And what we have in common with all other co-housing communities is that we have some common land, and we also have a common house. We all have our own individual houses and our own gardens that we own that are separate unit titles, but we also have a share in the common house and the common land. And the other thing that we have in common with all other co-housing communities is that we park along just one side of our property, and we all walk to our houses. And that way, that encourages social interchange, but it also lessens your footprint on the planet. You don't need so much concrete. So we actually just walk along paths to our houses rather than the drive-in garage, open the garage door, drive your car in, shut the garage door, and have no communication with anyone around you. So it's done very intentionally that you you walk through your house, through the neighbourhood to your house, which encourages you to, even if you just wave at your neighbours, you know, it encourages some kind of social interaction. So that's one side of us. We are a co-housing community. The other thing that we decided to do very early on was that we would be be as eco-friendly as we could be. And from that first meeting that Robin held, which is probably now over 10 years ago, some of our early members were part of that. Of course, we have a lot of people have gone along the way, and a lot of new people have come. And we decided when we got to the... First of all, what we needed to look for... First of all, we had to decide how we would communicate with each other. So we've got all sorts of ways of communicating with each other, and we actually have a whole set of communication agreements. And we... So when you become a member at Ursong, you kind of buy into our culture, really, which is, you know, treating each other respectfully and talking with I statements and, you know, stuff like that. And we also... have a whole set of legal agreements, because in order to build a co-housing community, people actually need to put their money in to initially at least buy the land, and you can't take it out, because if everybody started taking their money out, it just wouldn't happen. So we have quite complex legal documents that kind of bound everybody in so that we could finish the project, really. So, and we didn't have to invent all of these. Co-housing communities overseas have already, of course, gone down this road. So although we had to adapt a lot of stuff to our particular purpose, we had all of these to guide us, really. So we have, so when you, when we first started, everybody bought into and agreed to, how we were going to communicate with each other, and how we were going to move forward with the project, really. And we work on consensus, which means that everybody has to agree, really. So it's not a question of the majority rules here. It's a question of we all decide everything together, and if we can't make a decision, then that decision just doesn't happen, you know, and we work on it until we can find a solution that suits everybody. So sometimes that can be time-consuming, but it has the advantage of everybody being on board with an idea, rather than someone being disgruntled in the background saying, well, I never wanted to do that anyway. You know, that kind of doesn't happen. You know, we all go along together. So once we had some of these agreements in place, the next thing was to start looking for land. And we had a bit of criteria about land because we're an urban neighbourhood. We're not a country neighbourhood. We wanted to find land that was on the rail corridor, also on a regular bus route, because we wanted people to stop using their cars as much as possible. We wanted a clean piece of land, and that was a bit of a challenge, really, because a lot of there's a lot of old orchards and things around, but a lot of them have been very heavily polluted. So that was really important to us too. And of course, we had a budget. We had to find a piece of land within a certain budget. And we started looking in West Auckland because we felt that Waitakere City Council was probably the most eco-friendly council, and we knew that we would be, when it came to the building stage, we would be testing any council with the materials that we wanted to use and how we wanted to do things. So we really needed to work, we really needed to have a council that was really on board with what we were doing. So we thought Waitakere City Council would be their best bet. So we eventually found a piece of land in Ranui, here in West Auckland, and it was by chance. It had been one of those old Dalmatian orchards that had been farmed organically for the last 50-odd years, and that was more by chance than design. I think he was just, he didn't like sprayers and he didn't like artificial fertilizers, so we were just really lucky to find this very clean piece of land. And it was also within 5 minutes walking distance of the railway line and right on Swanson Road here, right on the bus route. So it met all of our criteria, including the price. Now, at that stage, and I think this is common in co-housing communities, you get a bit of fallout because, of course, a lot of people didn't want to live in Ranui, and, you know, some people wanted to live in Mission Bay, some people wanted to live on the edge of the water in Te Atatū. So there was all sorts of, so we did lose some people at that stage, but, of course, we also started to gain people as well, because we now actually had a piece of land and we could say we were starting. We were actually going to now go into the design stage of our buildings and you know, had something to show people. It wasn't just an idea anymore. We actually had an asset. So once we had the land, we had a big, huge open day, actually, to which politicians came and all sorts of people, the media. And our membership kind of grew, really, from that. And then we went into spending lots of time designing the choosing an architect and designing the project, which was quite a long and painful process. A huge amount of energy really went into that. And then the next big stage was, okay, now we have to find a builder and start building. And by this time we had decided that we were going to be building rammed earth houses, so we knew the sort of builders we were looking for. And put our whole project out for tender. And we had designed the whole village really to have 32 houses, and we at this stage we didn't have enough members to build 32 houses, so we decided to stage it. We had to stage it and build just 17. And so in 2001, the first residents moved in just on Christmas into the first 17 houses, and they carried on, and they weren't completed until May the next year, when finally all 17 were occupied and we were living here. And at that stage we hadn't built our common house, but there was an old farmhouse on the site that we used as our common house. Now, I should explain a bit about what the common house is for. It's the kind of centre of our village, and different co-housing communities build different things into their common house, but we're nearly finished our common house. We've actually knocked down the old farmhouse now and built a beautiful new common house. And basically we get together and eat together two or three times a week, and when we move into our new common house we may even do that more often, because it has a beautiful kitchen and a big dining room, so it's going to be very pleasant to all be able to cook together, because at the moment when we have meals together we cook in our individual homes and then take it along to a house that we all rent actually and sit there and eat together. So when we have our common house, it's going to be a lot easier. So the idea is that we can eat together several times a week. And we also have a children's playroom in the common house, a teen room, a common laundry. We don't have laundries in our houses. We have a shared common laundry, which means ultimately between 32 households, we'll only have 5 washing machines, because that's actually all we need. Which is another huge saving on the planet and on your pocket, actually. Not every house needs a washing machine. And we have a guest room there, so if you haven't got enough room in your house and you've got visitors, you can book the guest room and they can stay in the common house. We also have a resident sitting room. And we have an activities room, which we will use for whatever we decide to use it for, really, maybe yoga and tai chi and meditation or whatever, and an office. And we will also use it probably as some kind of educational facility. We would like to spread the word on living environmentally in an environmental way, and also about co-housing. You know, it would be lovely to see more co-housing communities spring up. And we intend to use our common house for seminars and things like that, so that we can spread the word, really. Then people can come and stay here and actually see what we're doing. They can actually see it really happening. So, and we're now in our very last stage of building. We have only got building the last 8 houses, and then we will be finished. And we should by that time have about somewhere between 50 and 60 residents. And it's quite interesting. I mean, I've been living here now for 3 years, and we're kind of learning every step of the way. You know, people ask us, how do you do this and how do you do that? And some of it, we have to do it as it comes up. We deal with things as they come up in the best way that we can. And so we're all learning how to live together and how to live environmentally. And we have meetings once a fortnight when we all get together and discuss all sorts of things. And we're really looking forward to being out of the building stage, actually, because we'll be able to focus on our gardens and learning what it means to live in community, really. So, yeah. So I think the thing that everybody has in common here is that, number one, they really want to live in a community, and number two, they care about the environment. So with those two things in common, we always manage to get by. So I think that just about sums us up. I don't know, that probably has raised a lot of questions that you would like to ask me. So
away I go.
Yes.
What is the area that you're in? One thing I found is very helped me a lot is your website.
Right.
Earthsong.org.nz?
That's right, yeah.
And when I went up on it, you can stay there for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, really, just perusing it all, because you've covered so many facets, particularly the technical side, all the different things like water, solar hot water, solar electricity, and then drinking water, how you treat the drinking water, storm water, and waste water. And then you've got all your unit costings, you've got spreadsheets and graphs.
That's right.
How you deal with rubbish, and then your cost savings too. It's really, basically, this is what is actually going to happen in the future. I can foresee see that, particularly in, say, 10 years or less, if our central government and local governments really get it together, because as we go more and more into this environmental crisis, we have to become more and more responsible, and you're locking it all down, whereas 100 years ago, when people sort of settled in New Zealand, it was everything was up for grabs and they could do anything and not worry a concern about waste or anything. Now, of course, we're looking at every single item, every virtual molecule that we put out into the atmosphere as, say, a greenhouse or a polluting gas. So we're locking everything down, and you have been able to show us so many ways in which to see that in summer there's less energy required for heat, and you have these graphs showing this. You also have you must use less water and hot water in summer as well. All these sorts of things. It's fantastic what you've done when you really have a close look at it. And so, can I go back? I want to deal with the people for a moment, because everything was done and it's intentional. Everyone's wanting at heart to come in and say, right, well, I like talking with neighbours. I like talking with people and sharing with people. I want my kids to be able to play in an area where I'm not constantly having to look at them because there are 10 or 15 other mums and dads in close proximity, either in the garden or looking out the window. And so you've got this protective womb in many cases. Is that right?
Yes.
How the kids play? Can you tell us a little bit about how the children interact inside the community?
Yeah, I must admit the children have a wonderful time here. We've got about... At the moment, we've got about 4 or 5 families, the children varying from, we've got teenagers down to 1.5-year-old. And the children are amazing. They play together as a team, and we have several things that we've developed, especially for the children. I mean, we have our children's room in the common house for the littlies, but we have a playhouse, and because we've got 4 acres here on which we live, there's quite a bit of variety for the children. We've got a little bush area and an open, bit of open meadow, so there's lots of places they can be, but they play together as one whole group most of the time. It's quite interesting how they, right from the teenagers through to the littlies, and they, the parents tell me they have a devil of a job getting the children to go anywhere. They never want to go away or even go on holiday. You know, they just feel they're missing out when they're not here. And it's the same when we have children visit, actually, often. It's really difficult for the parents to be able to get away. You know, the children just don't want to go. And it's great because the kids, you know, have developed a whole way of relating to each other. And they also, how can I put it? They're just so incredibly safe in here, really. There's no traffic. there's no kind of stranger danger because there's a whole heap of adults everywhere keeping an eye on them for a start. But we also know who's here. You know, whenever we have visitors at Ayersong, everybody kind of knows who's here. And so if people wander in who, and then we do get a lot of visitors who want to have a look around, and we always ask them to make an appointment because it's just never-ending, otherwise we would have a continual stream of people coming in. And we try and guard our privacy quite a lot, really. We have introduction days on the last Sunday of every month so that people who are genuinely interested can come on those days, and we will make appointments for people. You know, if someone's come overseas and they can't come on that particular day, but by and large, we really try to keep it like a rather large family, really, so that we always know who's around, and so it's incredibly safe for the children. And we also, we have these concrete paths everywhere, so it's great for them on their bikes and skateboards, and, you know, they have a, they live in a playground, you know, they truly do. And that because there's enough of them, there doesn't seem to be too many problems with them, you know. I think with a smaller group of children, you might get, I mean, sure, they have their fights, and they, but they get over it, you know, because they just want to get back out there, you know. So it's, you know, they're just, it reminds me very much when I was a child, I was brought up in a small village in England, and there was a gang of us who used to play on those late summer evenings, and we had a lot of freedom, and it was like the world was a different place then. And these children here seem to have been able to recapture that, you know, and it's lovely to see it, you know, that they have that kind of freedom, really. No fear of traffic, and you know, they can have a very safe place to play in.
Yes. Do you have pets?
Do we have what?
Pets.
We it's a very interesting one, that one. We have a pets policy. Now, it's something that a lot of co-housing communities around the world struggle with, because we really want to limit the cats. As environmentalists, we want to limit the cats because, of course, we lose the birds. And so our current pet policy is that if you move into Ayersong and you have a cat, you can bring it with you. But when that cat dies, you need to apply and go on a waiting list before you can replace it, because ultimately we only want to have about 5 cats on the property. We decided if we had no cats at all that we just get the neighbours' cats all the time. So we might as well have a few cats, but we really, really want to limit it. And it's coming up to review, actually. We're now thinking, should we have no cats at all, you know? But, you know, for some people, they really feel they want a cat. And we had one family, their young daughter wanted a cat, and another resident also wanted a cat. And what they did was they shared the cat. They got a cat between them, because, of course, they were only, you know, they were within walking distance of each other. They were only 5 houses away. And so they shared the cat, and that worked out really well. And that's the sort of thing that you do. Rather than getting 2 new cats, you know, you actually share a cat. and at the moment we have no dogs. We did have a dog at one stage that was a small lap dog, and we treated him as an honorary cat. But no one has actually come back yet and asked, can they have a dog? It's a bit tricky because we don't have fences and things between our houses. We actually plant for privacy between our houses. So to have a big dog here would be a bit tricky because there's nowhere really for the dog to be, if you know what I mean. We'd have to be tied up or something, and that would be a bit miserable. So we haven't really had to deal with that one yet. But and these things, you know, this could change. This particular policy we have at the moment could change at any time. You know, if something comes up, we review our policy and moderate it slightly or whatever. So, as I said, things come up all the time, and we kind of deal with them as they come up, because we could make a whole pile of rules and regulations and never need them. So we tend to think, okay, this is a problem, let's sit down and nut it out and work through it that way.
Well, you've got all your methods of conciliation or reconciling.
Yes.
Up on the web for us to have a look at, which
yes.
I think is wonderful, because you're setting up a prototype so that anybody else thinks, okay, well, we'd like to get together. You've already done the hard yards for everybody else, and it's superb that you've laid it all out. The open society has sort of been offered by you to to share with anybody who wants to come along and be involved with Eco Neighbourhood. So it's a grand gesture.
Well, we've always said it would be very sad if no one else did what we've done. You know, the whole idea is that you create good neighbourhoods one at a time, you know, and here's this one, and then we could grow another one from this one, and then another one from that one, and that's the way you change the world, really, you know, from a kind of a groundswell, really. And, our communication agreements are fantastic, really. I mean, they're very idealistic, and we're human, you know, sometimes we fall by the wayside, but we can always pick ourselves up again and say, hey, that didn't work because we forgot to do this, you know, or whatever. And, you know, and we do keep changing things a little as we go, you know. And we do have things sometimes where if we have something that we just cannot work out ourselves, we will call in an outside facilitator or mediator to help us work something through until all parties concerned have done that, have worked it through. Because we are a community, there's a commitment to have things work.
And again, this morning I went up and through the web, looked at all the pictures. You've got heaps of pictures showing from the first days when you started with the land,
yes,
to right up until fairly recently. I have noted there's no 2005 photographs up there.
No, there aren't. Our webmaster, as we call him, is currently up a mountain somewhere in the South Island. And we need to update our website, actually. There's a lot has happened in the last couple of years, actually, so we need to get some new pictures on there and kind of get into the website and revamp it, and we will be doing that soon.
Yes, because I took a sort of photographic tour of one of your houses, and
right,
of course it showed all the woodwork, and you had one where you had milk paint. Can you tell us a little bit about
this
milk paint?
Well, milk paint is the old-fashioned lime wash, and we actually painted our house with that just because we wanted to give it a go, actually. And it's basically plaster and skim milk, would you believe, like fresh skim milk, plaster, like plaster of Paris, and a little bit of lime. And it's a bit of a textured paint, but it's quite lovely, and it's a little hard to work with because you have to keep stirring it up all the time because the plaster keeps settling. You paint it on the wall, and what I did with the last coat, I put a little bit of colour in the last coat and just rag rolled it on the wall, so it has a kind of a veil effect on the wall, a very rather than a flat surface of colour, it has a kind of a veil, you know, a shimmered veil effect of colour on the wall. And a lot of people didn't do that because working with milk paint was a little tedious. But it's quite interesting that you can actually paint your walls with something so simple, really. And I think it cost us, we've got the bedrooms upstairs have jib on the wall, and the downstairs bedroom has three jibbed walls, and the ceiling is jib. And I think that cost us $30 to paint the whole house. So it was very cheap. But a lot of people did actually use eco paint that we get from Nelson, and they're not cheap. They're quite expensive paints, but they're totally eco friendly. And it's quite interesting one of the comments that people make when they walk into our houses is how nice they smell, because we only oil the timbers, and of course the timbers are all untreated, and we only oil them with tongue oil, and we only use eco paints or milk paint. So there's often when you go into a new house, it smells quite toxic. And so when you walk into our houses, they really smell gorgeous, because all you can smell is this lovely kind of citrus smell of the wood and the oil, and the paint doesn't have a smell at all, really, once it's dry. So it's very different to walking into a normal house. And, of course, the rammed earth walls themselves have nothing on them. They're just rammed earth, they have a character of their own as well, which is quite beautiful and goes very well with the wood.
Are they sort of like the adobe houses?
Yes, they are. They're very like adobe, and they have a kind of a, because they get rammed in layers, they have a kind of a bit like sand on the beach, a kind of a layered look, and I really love it. You know, sometimes people come in and say, oh, can you paint the wall? And I always say, well, you could paint the wall, but I don't know quite why you would want to paint the wall, because once you paint it, you've got to keep on painting it. And the whole idea of the Rammed Earth too is that it's very breathable. Moisture passes in and out of it, and these houses are incredibly dry. You know, we never get suffer from condensation, for instance. I've never seen it actually on our windows. And even in the bathroom, the houses are very well ventilated. We have one of these little whirly-giggy things on the roof that's just driven by the wind, and it just takes all moisture out of the house, actually. And consequently, they're very dry and very warm in winter and very cool in the summer. They really do that. You know, they're a total what they call a solar passive design. All of our houses face north to maximise the sun, and we have a what they call a pergola outside, which is you can grow something like a grapevine over in the summer to give you shade, but you know, will be bare in the winter so that the sun can still get through and into the house and warm it up. And these houses are very warm. It's quite interesting. Sometimes you come home from work and you think, oh, there's a heater on in the house, but there isn't. It's just retained the warmth from the day. And it's quite a subtle thing. I noticed we had to get one of these temperature things to put on the window because I needed to know what the outside temperature was in the morning before I get dressed, because otherwise I go outside and it's much colder than I think it is, or in the summer, conversely, it's much warmer outside, and I think, oh, I'm overdressed. So it's very handy to have one of those temperatures that you can stick on the window, and it tells you what the outside temperature is. I mean, of course, you could bother to go outside and check as well, but often in the winter you don't. You know, you just think, oh, it looks like a nice day, and when you go out, you haven't got enough clothes on. So it's a very subtle kind of a retaining of the sun's warmth in the house.
Well, yes, because we've got hay bale and mud brick being used here in New Zealand too, and I'm sure lots of listeners will be very interested that you're happy with Rammed Earth and people who want to experiment with it. I guess, so you could possibly get quite a few people come and take a far closer look now.
Definitely.
At your design protocols,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah, we get quite a few people coming to have a look who want to build an eco-friendly house, and they want to have a look at what it looks like and what it feels like. And our Rammed Earth walls, they're about, in old-fashioned measurements, probably about a foot and a half thick. So they're very insulating. As I said, they carry the moisture in and out, but they're also, because we have terraced houses, the houses, it's just a fantastic sound insulation. We never hear a thing from our neighbour next door because, you know, the walls are so thick. So they also act as a terrific sound barrier as well. And there's something about the quality of the sound inside the houses as well that's really nice. You know, when you play music or whatever, the acoustics are really pleasant, actually. Mm. And they feel very different to ordinary wooden homes, actually. We have a lot of people come in who say they feel very European. And I think they're talking old European as opposed to modern European houses. And because of all the natural wood as well, I suppose, there's not much decorating to do, really. Once you've oiled the timber, you know, it's every now and again, I suppose, if you wanted to, you could put more oil on them. But, you know, we haven't been touched for 3 years now.
And what sort of timbers do you use?
Okay, we've used macrocarpa and poplar, and on the most recent one, we've used Douglas fir, we've used, I'm just trying to think, forgotten what the outside cladding was on stage one. The most recent houses are now being done in cedar, but it's Canadian cedar, but it's Canadian cedar grown in New Zealand, so it's very sustainable. So we're not using an imported exotic timber. We're using a timber that's grown in New Zealand that is specifically for building with. So there's a big difference there between buying cedar that's imported from Canada, which is their native forest, or buying cedar that's grown in New Zealand. So so it's been purpose-built for the building industry, and it's beautiful-looking timber. You know, it's really lovely.
Yes, timber smells are lovely because of the fragrance of...
Yeah. Yes, it's really gorgeous, yeah.
And I wasn't able to see the size of, say, your living room or lounge in your picture. So can, in the planning stage, can you, is there a particular size that you can build a room to, or do you, are you allowed a certain amount of freedom provided the shape stays?
Yeah, once we had picked on a design, the design is the same for every house, but there's certain options you can pick and choose. And, of course, a lot of houses are mirror images of other houses, so they actually feel very different. And it's quite interesting because although we've only got one design, every house you go into is actually quite different. It's been done very cleverly, actually. But our houses tend to be slightly smaller than average houses because we have the common house. So you don't have a laundry in your house, and you often don't need that extra spare bedroom because you've got guest accommodation in the common house. So our houses were, and it's the same in a lot of co-housing communities, their houses are slightly smaller than normal because you don't spend all your time just in your house. You know, you can spend quite a lot of time in the common house. So they are slightly smaller. I mean, we've had people come in and say, oh, you don't have an ensuite, you know, and you don't have this and you don't have that. And it's also because we're trying to be conservative in not making the houses too lavish. You know, I mean, the whole thing about living in an eco way is to not be greedy with what you need, really. And so we tend to be, for that reason, we design quite compact houses. But I suppose our living space is probably, I better pace it out, but I think it's something like 12 metres by 12 metres, something like that. That may sound a bit big. I don't know, actually. I'm not very good on metrics. And it's probably on the website, actually, I think, the dimensions. But they're very open plan. And the three-bedroom houses, the downstairs bedroom is downstairs, and the door that leads through into the third bedroom is like a double door. It can open right up, so you can use that as an extension of your living space if you want to. And even a young family who have that, use that as their downstairs family room. You know, it's like their kids' playroom, but it's totally attached to the lounge, you know. And I certainly never feel that my house is small. I always feel I've got stacks of room, really, so, yeah.
Warm and cozy.
Yes.
Yes.
Cozy.
Now, with the water, of course, anybody who's conscious of what we take into our bodies wants to have the best of everything, be it the organics of food, fresh air and water. Now, I noticed that you had ozone as a treatment process for water as against this horrible chlorine. Can you tell us anything about that?
I don't know what that is, actually. That's a bit of a new one on me. I'm not quite sure what they're referring to there.
We do
collect our own water. We collect our own stormwater off the roof into tanks. Now, that was, you're not usually allowed to do that in the city, but once again, as I said, we chose Waitakere City because we hoped that they would work with us on this. And they did. You know, we actually now have what they call an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding with the council. And we've had everybody who works with the council through here. We've had 600 council workers have been through here on a tour, so they understand what we're trying to do. So when we go to the council and we say we're from Erzsong, they think, oh, yes, I've been there. I know what you guys are trying to do. So they have allowed us to collect the rainwater off the roof. And that gets pumped back into our houses. Now, it does not. The only thing we're not allowed to do with it is drink it. We bathe in it and we use it in the toilets, and it goes into the hot water system. But we're not allowed to have it for drinking water. But we, in our common house, we do have a water filter, so we can use that rainwater filtered to drink if we so wish. And some people have water filters in their houses so that they can drink that water. I think the only reason the council object to that is because it hasn't been chlorinated, and they like to chlorinate the water because, as far as they're concerned, it kills the bugs. And we've just been doing an interesting thing recently with our water tanks with Eco Water, which is a branch of the council, and they come and test. They come and test our tanks. They take water samples out. We've got six of them, and they take samples out once a month. and read all the levels in it for bacteria, and they've actually just started testing for zinc as well, because, you know, we now have a problem in our waterways with zinc, which is mainly the runoff from, I think the worst offender is roofs on factories, actually, and that's actually killing the marine life, getting into the sea and killing the marine life. So they're checking our runoff from our roofs to see what our readings are, which is going to be very interesting. So so we use every drop of water we can. Now, when the water tank in the winter, when we got lots of water, the water tanks can overflow into what we call a swale system, and we have swales that go through the property, which are really just indentations in the earth where the water can run down, and we have them between every block of house, all the blocks of houses, and then we have a main swell out on the main path, and it ends up in the pond. And if that gets incredibly, you know, if we have a 100-year flood or something, there is then a an outlet from our pond into the stormwater. But it was estimated that by the time we have 32 houses here and the common house, there will be no more water leaving this property than there was when it was an orchard. So we're using as much water as we can, which, of course, in turn takes an awful lot of pressure off of all the infrastructure for stormwater that we have in Auckland. Unfortunately, we're not yet allowed to do anything with our grey and black water. That's mainly a building regulation, and we're waiting with bated breath for some time in the future when that changes, and we can actually also deal with our own grey water and our own toilet water on site. And we have future-proofed our sewerage so that we can do that. We have it all going. It just goes down both sides of the property, so that sometime in the future we can build our own little mini sewerage treatment plant on site, which we would very much like to do, but unfortunately the laws of the land aren't allowing us to do that at the moment, and so that will be another trail that we will blaze down as soon as we possibly can. because, you know, it would be really lovely to think that we had almost zero impact on the environment, really.
Well, as a unit, and the acreage that you've got, you're doing extremely well, because you're a prototype and you're pioneering something that I feel that once people get in and go and dissolve into it for half a day,
and sit
amongst the garden, sit with the kids, go into one of your little houses, experience it, because we need to have some excellent examples, and that can be sort of replicated with variations of the theme, of course.
Yes, I mean, we have had groups from Christchurch come to visit us, actually, and one of the things they asked was why we didn't have double glazing, and I said to them, well, we don't really need it in Auckland, and these houses are so well insulated that we just didn't feel that we needed double glazing, whereas in Christchurch they probably would. So that would be, you know, they could replicate exactly what we've done, but they would do something like put in double glazing. Because I must admit, these houses, I haven't talked about our power usage, actually. We have solar hot water panels on the roof, and our water tanks are up there as well. And we also have trained ourselves, and we have educated ourselves, to not use too much power. Like in the winter when you come home, you don't turn on the heater and the oven at the same time. You only turn on one, so that you don't have that... I think what happens in Auckland is everybody comes home from work and they turn on all the lights and the heater and the oven and make some toast or something, you know, and whoops, all of a sudden, New Zealand, Auckland can't cope with the power surge, you know, there's too much of a drain. So we've trained ourselves to not do that, and the other big plus we have too is this solar hot water heating. It's a huge saving. We have a dual system. If there's not enough sun, we have a readout on the wall here that tells me the temperature of my water tank. And the power, if my water's not hot enough, I can switch the switch on, and for 2 hours at night, it comes on and heats up my water. So if the sun isn't shining, you can still have hot water. You know, we don't go without hot water or anything. However, it is amazing. The sun does not, people don't understand. It's not the heat from the sun, it's the light from the sun. And so on a day that's really cold, if it's sunny, your hot water tank will still heat up. It's incredible. And we are two adults that live in a three-bedroom house, and our power and water average all year round cost is about $40 a month. So it's a huge saving.
Yes.
I mean, I've lost touch now with what people normally pay for their power bills, but I would imagine they're somewhere between $100 and $150 a month in Auckland, probably all year round. And I think 60% of your power bill is hot water. And, you know, the sun's just shining here, you know. We're not damaging the sun by using it to heat our water. You know, so it's a very nil impact on the environment.
Yes, well, I think as somebody doing a PhD on power saving and utilage, it would be a very good one to have them study your system so that they can go direct to central government, and central government can say, right, we'll put solar hot water systems on every house over the next 5-year period. That would be what we call visionary government.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And the same with water tanks, actually. If instead of building new dams and things, if they helped people have water cylinders, water tanks, then, you know, they would save all of the infrastructure that they need to build in order to get water to people's houses. I mean, goodness knows, there's enough of it falls in Auckland. You know, if we could just collect it and use it, you know, it just seems so wasteful.
In Australia, they're doing this. At the moment, particularly in Queensland, Toowoomba are so desperate for water, they're looking at recycling sewerage, and there's a huge hue and cry over there. They're that desperate. So I think, again, if we got the government involved and they said, right, we'll give you rebates and we'll make sure that this water that you have in your tank, we can get rid of all the cryptosporidium and the giardia and whatever, and we could drink really good water, and health and vitality would come as a result.
Absolutely.
Oh boy, well, fantastic. And you're cooking. Do you cook by gas or electricity?
We cook, well, our stoves are dual, actually. The tops are gas and the ovens are electric. We chose that because basically, gas. Well, you know, we looked at the whole thing of using gas, but gas ovens are just not as efficient as electric ovens, and so we decided to not do that. And we actually have their LPG; they're actually bottled gas, and we fill them up. And I think they seem to last about 3 months, and it costs us about $15 to fill them up. So it's pretty cheap cooking, really.
Very good. And there's one other thing. I looked at some of these photos again and looked at your bench tops.
Yes.
And you have got no, what you call it, waste disposer.
No.
In your sink. So could you tell us, you compost certain amounts,
yes,
but you've got
this.
Yes,
we have common compost bins. And when we first lived here, of course, everybody was taking all their veggie scraps down there, and far too many vegetable scraps in the compost bin, you know, and not enough green matter going in. So we thought, okay, we need to rethink this, you know. What are we going to do with all these veggie scraps? And so we have a bit of a dual system, and a lot of houses here have what we call a bokashi bucket. I don't know if you've heard about bokashi, but bokashi, I'll give them a bit of a plug here because I think they're pretty fantastic. And it's you have a bucket sitting inside a bucket, and the top bucket has a few little holes in the bottom, like a colander. And that's just to let liquid run through. And basically you put your veggie scraps in this bucket and you sprinkle on this medium that looks incredibly like breadcrumbs, but it has all sorts of beneficial bacteria in it. And you layer that through your, as you add your veggie scraps, you just sprinkle a bit on the top and then you put the lid back on and then, you know, add more veggie scraps and sprinkle on another layer. And when your bucket's full, you put it to one side and you leave it for a week to kind of cook. And then at the end of the week, you lift the top bucket out, which has, you know, started to decompose, and you just go and dig a hole in your garden, and you put the contents of the bucket into the hole, and you mix a bit of soil in with it, and you cover it up. And let me tell you, when you go to dig in that space 6 weeks later, it's completely disappeared. So it's fed your garden. It stopped filling up landfills, and you totally put everything you eat back into the garden. And, you know, we eat organically, so you know you're putting really good stuff back into the soil. And it stops all of that kind of too much wetness and too many veggie scraps in the compost bin. You know, some people still use the compost bin, but, you know, a lot of us now have these Bocacci buckets, and the liquid that you collect in the bottom of it is very acid, so you have to water that right down. But we watered that right down, and last year we put that on my banana trees, and we were rewarded with the most wonderful bunch of bananas off the tree. So, you know, it was like from what most people throw out in their rubbish, you know, went back in our garden and came back to us as a bounty of food. And I just think, you know, there is no reason why everybody can't be doing that. Can you imagine how much rubbish, less rubbish we would have if everybody had, you know, a couple of Bocacci buckets in their house and got rid of their food scraps that way? And I put literally everything in there, everything. You know, none of this, or you can't put citrus in, and you can't put eggshells in, and you can't put bones in. You know, I put everything in. And it just works really well.
Yes, yes. Is there any area where you actually have lawn where the sound of a lawnmower vibrates through the day? Because I know that kids like to be able to have a small area, sort of half the size of a tennis court, where they can kick a ball or run around.
We do. We have an area, we call it the meadow. We have a corner of our property, there's a little bit of bush, and then just in front of it is what we call the meadow, and that also overlooks our pond. And that's quite a big area, actually. There's a few plum trees and things there, but it's probably the size of how big a football field is. I don't think it's quite that big. It probably is about half the size of a football field, actually. And, the kids love it up there. It is a place that a ball can be kicked around, and it does get mowed. We're not that keen on lawn mowers or weed eaters, but they are a bit of a necessary evil at this stage. We practice organic permaculture, and ultimately it would be that we would love to put down some sort of a lawn that doesn't need mowing, but we might have to investigate that one further. But it is very nice to have a lawn area, actually. And we also, ultimately, when we finish building our common house, we will have a little bit of a village green outside there as well. Actually, it's on two levels. It'll be like a little amphitheatre so the children can do plays and things for us, and we can sit around and watch them. So we have a couple of areas that are like that. But, I mean, really, around us are our neighbours, of course, and we hear their lawnmowers going at the weekend, but they seem to... here we have one lawnmower between 32 households. I think we're doing pretty well.
Very, very good. What about rates? How do they work, rates?
Our rates work just exactly the same as they do on a normal house there, because we have unit title, so everybody has separate rates. We have, and I think the rates on our three-bedroom house, they're around about $1,000 a year. I do believe they're going to go up soon. The council are putting the rates up soon. And the other charge we have is we do have body corp fees, and that's basically to run our common house. And it also includes our insurance. You know, we insure all together so that it's a better rate. If there's anything left over, we spend it on landscaping. And our body corp fees are about $20 a week. So, and people tell me that's pretty cheap for body corporates. You know, I don't know about, most apartments have a body corporate charge for lighting and things. So we have that.
Well, it sounds like it's a very profound experiment that people are enjoying, and we're seeing what you call an excellent example of how we can live together.
Definitely. Well, we've built our houses to last somewhere between 200 to 500 years, so we intend to be here, if not in body, in spirit, for a long time.
Excellent. Well, Lippy, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. I'm sure that it's going to be a lot of people interested, and they can go up www.earthsong.org.nz.
That's the one.
And they can make contact.
Yes, absolutely.